This week is a double parsha, Netzavim Vayelech. It's interesting that these two parsha don't always appear together, but when they do, they seem to represent almost opposite themes. Right? Netzavim, Nitzav is to stand. Hityatzvu ur'u et Yeshuat Hashem. Hashem says, stand and watch how Hashem saves you. By the way, where does God say that? Okay, actually, Moshe, whatever. Where? Kriyat Yamsuf, right? The splitting of the sea. Because we're just standing, and Hashem is doing it. Atem nitzavim ayom. This is a different kind of nitzavim. This is after 40 years. Take a pause. Take a moment. Because you're about to change history. You're about to enter Eretz Yisrael. Moshe is about to die. The first generation is pretty much all gone. And they're about to enter Eretz Yisrael. And yet the parsha is Nitzavim, to stand. Second parsha, Vayelech, that Moshe goes. So it's interesting that there are two very different perceptions. To walk is pretty much almost the opposite of to stand. And yet these are connected. Almost as if to say, sometimes you got to walk and sometimes you got to stand. So I'll tell you something interesting. When you take the road from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, you eventually pass on your left a place called Latrun. Okay? Door open or something? Is that why all that noise is coming in? No, it's not. Open. It's from, there's a hashbar. Can you close the windows there? There's a hashbar or something, so the microphone is, thanks. Right? So, sorry about that. So, if you travel the road to Tel Aviv, you will eventually come on a summit called Latrun. And for those of you who've been there before, Latrun is actually has become the home of the Armored Corps. It's the Armored Corps Museum, Shiryon. All of the tkatzim, all the ceremonies of the Armored Corps are at Latrun. There's a tank museum. But Latrun really became legend because of the Battle of Latrun in 1948. In 1948, Latrun was held by the Jordanians. And if you drive on the highway, you notice this, you'll see actually a tank very up high on a pillar. That's how you'll know it's a Hotchkiss, an old tank. It's a very strategic spot. And whoever controls that spot, certainly back in the day when, you know, warfare was a little more slow-paced, whoever controlled that spot controlled the road between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and therefore controlled Jerusalem. So there was a fierce battle for this place. 7 times the Israelis attempted to take the hill, and they did not succeed. It was only much, much later that we eventually took Latrun. Okay? But there was a legend born in Latrun. And you can see that legend when you enter Bad Echad, when you walk into officers. Of course, there's a base deep in the Negev in the south that basically is where every officer trains. Okay? Is where every officer trains. Right? And there's a stone motto on the wall. And it says the word Acharai. After me. It's a very strange word. And that legend was born in Latrun. Now you got a picture of the scene. It's 1948. Israel was desperately outnumbered. They were surrounded by 6 Arab armies alongside the Jordanian legion, which was already in country. They were outnumbered 15-1. They had no real air force, a few planes. They had no tanks. They had almost no heavy guns. Right? And they were facing 7 Arab armies. The chances, the pundits were debating how many days it would be before they were massacred. So they were taking every able-bodied volunteer they could find. Rav Herzog gave permission to dig ditches on Shabbat in Park HaYarkon because they were expecting mass casualties, thousands. So what do? There's a refugee boat, and the British are finally out. and the refugees that are wallowing in the DP camps in Cyprus, in Europe, are finally starting to come home. Now, there's a limited number of boats. They can't bring them all at once. There are hundreds of thousands of them. So they start to bring them boatload by boatload. And they actually had a selection process because there's a war on. So there's a selection process. Who do you want to bring first? Not the old and the weak and the children. There weren't many children. You want to bring the able-bodied, young men and women who you thought could fight. And that's how they did it. And as people approached the coastline and got off the boats, they were asked, are you willing to volunteer? And many answered the call. They didn't have a proper training camp. They didn't go to basic training and then, you know, weapons training and tank school. They gave them a gun. They took them into a ravine. They gave them a few bullets. They showed them how to shoot. And off they went to war. And any time there was a heavy battle and they were trying to bring troops, so they would rush some of these new volunteers into the fight, hoping that manpower would help sway the tide. Because if the Arabs are coming up the hill and they see 11 guns instead of 3, then that makes all the difference. So they were trying to take Latrun, and it was a disaster. So they started pouring these recruits into the battle. But these recruits knew nothing. They didn't know Hebrew. Imagine you're a commander, and half your men have been killed. And so they bring you 30 soldiers or reinforcements. But these 30 soldiers, they don't know how to fight. And they speak German, Polish, Hungarian, Czech, Russian, Yiddish. How do you even tell them what to do? How do you issue a command? How do you get them to understand? You yell at them to go, they can't go. So there's only one way to do that. You just start to move up the hill. And you say, Acharai, and there's a symbol of this officer who's heading up the hill into battle with his arm outstretched as if to say, follow me. And that is the legend of Acharai. And I always thought that was a good story. And thought it was a principle worth thinking about. Because in whatever leadership position you find yourself, whether it's a parent, or you're a camp counselor, or maybe one day in the army, or you're on campus and you're a campus leader, people will not listen to what you say, they will watch what you do. And so you have to lead by example. And I'll tell you when this really came home to me. We were in Lebanon. You know, the Russians have a fixed earth doctrine. What that means is they believe in static positions in certain scenarios. And Russian officers do the exact opposite. The Arabs were trained by the Russians, so therefore the Arabs do the same thing. The officer isn't in front, the officer's in the back. And there's actually a certain logic to that. Because if you're the officer and you know what's going on, it's kind of dumb that you're in front and you're the one who's going to get shot. On the other hand, if your officer's in front, the motivation to fight is very powerful. So the Russians did the opposite. And we were in the Shuf Mountains in Lebanon. So many of the roads, mountain warfare is a completely different type of warfare. It's called Lichima B'Shetach Harari, fighting in a mountainous zone. There are a lot of challenges with mountain warfare. Chief amongst them is usually only the tank in front can be brought to bear. Think about a column of tanks on a mountain road. They can't spread out. So the tank who's second in line can't fire because he's got a tank in front of it. So unless they're on a very steep hill, which is a very rare scenario, basically the one who fires is the one in front. They're trying to get somewhere. So what the Russians used to do, and therefore what the Arabs used to do, and in this case the Syrians, is they would plant turrets around the bend in the road. So imagine you're heading up a mountain road, and you're heading towards Jizin, or in Tzchalta, one of these villages in the Shuf, right? You never know what's waiting around the corner. And you come around a corner, and waiting around the corner is a T-62 tank turret, just the turret. It's not big enough to be a tank. In fact, I once asked sort of why there was no air support. They said because at the time, the air support didn't see these turrets. They were so small and so well camouflaged. And all you needed was a gunner. You didn't need a commander, you didn't need a loader, you needed a driver, right? There was a gunner and he was in the turrets. And there was a guy behind him who would feed him the shells. And that was it. And they were under a tree or a branch or around the bend in the road. And not only that, but imagine that you're facing a bend in the road. You've got your gun sighted on the bend in the road. The gunner is sitting there. You can hear armored columns coming. He's got his finger on the trigger. All he has to do is wait for the tank to come around the road. And you as a tank commander have to hope that he's going to wait for the perfect shot. Because if he doesn't wait for the perfect shot, then he's going to hit the front of the tank before the gun can come around the bend. And so you're driving up this mountain road, right? You've got your finger, there's a mashbet, there's an override control. You're in the turret of the tank. Your driver is driving. Your loader is standing by. Your gunner is in the turret. You don't really have time to keep redirecting the gunner because the gunner is looking through this very narrow, 8 times magnified scope through the gun, but he can't see what's over there because he can only see where the gun is. So you override with this mashbet, this override control, and you're constantly bringing the gun around. Now, if you're doing this in a video game, and the whole video game is 30 seconds, that's no problem. But if you're doing this for an hour, it's only a matter of time before you can't stay focused for an hour. So eventually, you're a little off, and you come around the corner, and there's a T-62 tank. And it's just a question of who fires first. And usually, these were companies of tanks, so who's in front in a company? The company commander. Company commanders are hard to come by. So I remember the discussions. They decided that they weren't going to let company commanders lead the tank columns, and we were given orders that platoon commanders had to be in front. Right? A platoon commander, Sagam, is a guy with one bar, okay? Whereas the company commander could have 3 bars. So he's now a couple tanks back, and you're in front. And I want you to know, for years after the Army, I used to have nightmares about this. This was my ultimate nightmare. Just waiting for the tank to fire. Can you imagine the pressure that builds up? Right? And all of a sudden, the notion of acharai makes sense, because you're a platoon commander. You went through 1.5 years of training in officer's corps. Why don't they just put a sergeant in front? Well, because you need a commander in front. But why don't they put the company commander? Well, because the company commanders were getting killed. So they put the platoon commander in front, because the company commanders are killed in front, so now the platoon commander's in front, and you're the platoon commander, and this starts to sink in. Acharai. What does that mean? What do you do with that? I want to share with you an idea from this week's parasha. And I'm going to follow the principle of my wife, less is more. This is a very difficult parasha. You know? You start Sefer Yoshua. It's very interesting. Sefer Yoshua begins with the word and. When was the last time you read a book that started with the word and? It's a somewhat incongruous word to begin with. Because and seems to mean also, right? So you should start with the Yoshua Ba or something like that. Right? Vayehi, and it was in the times of Yoshua. So the word and is a little strange. The Malbim, right? The Meir Leibishloi, who was a 19th century commentator. It's safe to say that if people say, well, did people really learn Tanakh? Did people really study the Nevi'im, prophets, the writings? That once the Malbim came around, that question no longer applied. And the Malbim, in the footsteps of the Abarbanel, he did something powerful, because many of the commentators that came before, Rashi, the Radak, they were interested in translating the word or the verse. The Abarbanel came along, and he wanted to understand what was going on at the time. He wanted to create and to give you the whole picture. And the Malbim followed in those footsteps, and he paints for you the history and the picture of the time. It's amazing to see the Malbim. So I believe it's the Malbim. I could be getting it wrong. Maybe the Radak. Who basically suggests, well, the word vayi doesn't, you know, it's a strange word. But the truth is, it's not so strange. Where else do we find the word vayi in the beginning of a book? Vayi bimei Achashverosh. Right? And in fact, there are a number of books that start with the word vayi. So I heard a shiur in the name of Rav Roizman, who quoted Rav Avigdor Miller, this is a tzal, who shared a fascinating idea. He said, what does the word vav mean? Why do we start with the word and? Because when we read the book of Yoshua, we're just starting Yoshua. We're just looking at the picture in front of us. Right? You know? It must have been an incredible time. They'd gotten out of Egypt. The first generation of Jews had died out with all their challenges. The Jews were on the banks of the Jordan River. They'd been dreaming of this for 40 years. It's like I had a chavruta in Gush, a study partner in Gush,
Reuven Etias, and he was from Ethiopia. He was actually a Tigri. And he told me once of his journey, how they, for 10 days, went through the Sudan. And he described to me how the Beta Israel, how the community of Ethiopia, how they had dreamed for hundreds of years of coming down to Yerushalayim. And what it was like to suddenly realize they were seeing Yerushalayim. It was like in a dream. And by the time I got to him, you know, it was 10 years later, he was in Gush, he was learning. He said, whenever I say the Shira Ma'alot, the verse that really gets me is Ayinu Kecholmim. We were like dreamers. So when we came to Eretz Israel, it was like a dream. It was like, it was crazy. Right? We don't appreciate that. So, that's what it must have been like as they were preparing to enter Eretz Israel. And yet, not so simple. Because the Jewish people had been in existence only 40 years. This was a young nation. And in the 40 years since the nation of Israel was born in the Exodus, in Yitzhak Mitzrayim, they had only known one leader, Moshe. And now Moshe is gone. And everything you read about at the beginning of Yeshua, Moshe Avdi Met, my servant Moshe is gone, the transition has to be understood against the backdrop. So it's Parshat Vayelech. And Moshe is getting ready to say goodbye. And echoing words that were said 40 years earlier, right? In Perek Lamed Aleph, in the 31st, in fact, in this week's Double Parshat will be Chamishi, at the 5th Aliyah. Vayikra Moshe Yoshua. Moshe calls Yoshua. Vayomer Elav La'enei Kol Yisrael. And he says to him, before the entire people of Israel. Why does Moshe tell him this before the entire people of Israel? Think about that. Chazak ve'ematz. Be strong and of courage. Ki ata tavo et ha'am hazeh la'aretz, asher nishba Hashem la'avotam lotet lahem. Ata tavo is a very strange terminology. Tavo is you will come. Ata tavo is you will come. Right? You will come the people. You don't come the people, you come to the people. Right? So, we have to understand what that means. Right? Ata tavo et ha'am hazeh, you will come with the people into the land of Israel. Right? La'aretz asher nishba Hashem la'avotam lotet lahem. To the land that Hashem has sworn to their forefathers, and you will inherit it, you will conquer it. You will be the vehicle that allows the Jewish people to come home. That's amazing. Okay. By the way, why is this Le'nei Kol Yisrael? Why is Moshe doing this in front of the whole people of Israel? What do you think? Why does Moshe have to tell Yoshua, be strong and of courage, because you're going to bring the people home? Why is that doing in front of the whole Jewish people? Like, we know Yeshua is going to... Nobody, really? Nobody? Yeah?
Moshe wanted to show the people
that Yeshua would be strong for them. I think there's a stage before that, yeah?
He's passing the torch and he's telling you, this is your people now, and you need to lead them.
So he's telling to Yeshua, this is your people. Well, Yeshua knows this is his people, but okay, I hear that, yeah?
It's kind of forcing Yeshua into the situation that he has to put in his mantle,
yeah? He's forcing Yeshua to take up the mantle. Look, Hashem has told Moshe, Kachet Yeshua v'chaskeu v'amtseu, way back in Bamidbar. Hashem is the one who tells Moshe, take Yeshua, he's going to take the kihu yamchil ta'amaze, he's going to bring him in. So Yeshua doesn't have a choice, and Moshe doesn't have a choice. We're forgetting the most important part of this equation, yeah? And what message do they have to hear? I want to tell you something. So Moshe dies, and 30 years later they're about to cross the Jordan River. What happened the last time Moshe disappeared? Remember that? What was the last time Moshe disappeared? They start dancing with a golden calf, and he was only gone for a day. 30 days later, they figured out by now, he's not coming back. He's gone. There's an unbelievable Gemara. Unbelievable Gemara. Powerful Gemara. The Gemara in Tmura. I think it's Daf Chep, but I might be getting the Daf wrong. Ted Zayin, maybe? The Gemara in Tmura says that eventually the Jewish people ask Yeshua a question. And what does Yeshua say? He says, I don't know. It's a good question. Now, you know, here at Oraita, I think that's a valuable answer. I think if you don't know the answer to the question, doesn't matter how great a Torah scholar, In fact, I think you can learn more from Rav Lau when he says, I don't know, than when he gives you the answer. Because that's amazing. Then Rosh Hashiva can say, I don't know. And just so that you'll feel I'm great, I say, I don't know all the time, just for you, right? Can you imagine what it was like for the Jewish people to say, I don't know? The Jewish people never heard that before. When the Jewish people come to Moshe and they ask him a question, there are only two possibilities. He either gives them the answer, he says, huh, let me ask the boss. Talks to God, gives him the answer. But no tzlavcha, the daughters of tzlavcha, they don't know what to do. Do they inherit the land? No problem, we'll ask God. Yeshua says, I don't know. You know what the Jewish people want to do? It's unbelievable. We'll talk about it. Grateful people. They want to shecht him. They want to kill him. Now, it's agadic. It's not literal. They're, who is this leader? You know what God does? It's unbelievable. God says to them, stop answering their questions. It's time to conquer the land. Start conquering the land and forget about their questions. That's brilliant. Go to war, and they'll forget about their questions. That's what every Arab army has done in the last 60 years, by the way. So this is not exactly, you know, building confidence, but okay. This is a complicated time. Moshe wants the Jewish people to see that he is passing the mantle. That Yeshua is the leader, and Moshe has given him the leadership because God has told him to give him the leadership. That's powerful. Right? Okay. Ki atatavi et atatavo et ha'amazel ha'aretz shenishbashta. You will go with this. You will come in with the Jewish people. You're going in. Except that that is verse 7, Pasuk Zayin. And you look ahead to Pasuk Chav Gimel. Not so far away that we forgot. Right, Moshe writes down the song, Azinu, that's another discussion. And he commands Yeshua, Vayomer, Chazak Ve'ematz. So God tells Moshe to tell Yeshua. And then commands, Ki atat tavi et bnei Yisrael ha'aretz shenishbat lehem v'anochi ha'emach. You will bring the Jewish people in. So the first time it says atat tavo, and the second time it says atat tavi. The first time it says you will go with them, and the second time it says you will bring them in. Listen to what Rashi says. Rashi takes notice of this. You with me here? Rashi takes notice of this. Moshe amar li Yoshua. This is Gemara in Sanhedrin. Zekenim shebado yiyu imach. The elders will be with you. Hakol lefi datan v'atzatan. Right? Atat tavo, you will come to Jewish people. That means take advice from the zekenim. Take advice from the leadership. Don't do this on your own. Committee. Sometimes leadership by committee is a very healthy thing. Consensus. Let's all in this together. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Omer, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God says to Yeshua, Ki ata tavi et bnei Yisrael ha'aretz. Tavi al korcham, bring them against their will. HaKol talui b'cha. It's all dependent on you. It's not a committee. Tul makel, take the stick. V'achal kodkodan, and smack him on the head. Daver echad ledor, v'lo shnei dorim ledor. There can be only one leader, not two. A ship has a captain, there can be only one captain. There can be only one. So which is it? Is it atatavi or atatavo? Is it you will come with the Jewish people into the land or you will lead them into the land? And why, if it's you'll lead them into the land, does the Gemara go so far as to say you're going to have to smack them over the head? They're not going to listen to you. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, listen to the Zekenim. Take their advice. These are two completely opposed perceptions, and they're right next to each other. The Torah Tzmimah of Baruch Halevi Epstein, you know I love the Torah Tzmimah, it's my wife's ancestor. So the Torah Tzmimah, who, by the way, was a very, almost an unexpected leader. He was actually a businessman in a small business. His father was the Aruch HaShulchan. His father was the undisputed Gadol Ador of Lithuania. He was one of the, probably the greatest mind in Lithuania. He was the Posek Ador of his generation. He wrote the Aruch HaShulchan. The clarity of his thought and the way he lays out every sugi is incredible. If anybody wants a little further demonstration of how you could really study a piece from the Gemara to the Tosefta and the Braitot and everything else, down to the Halacha, all the Rishonim, but really clear, that would be the Aruch HaShulchan. Okay? And he had a son, Baruch Halevi.
Baruch HaLevi, by the way, learned in Valazhin. He was a student of the Netziv. The Netziv remarried his mother, so he was kind of like the nephew or his mother's sister, I forget, right? And he got stuck in World War I in Pinsk. Later on, he died in the ghetto in Pinsk in 1940 in his 80s. But in World War I, he was stuck, and due to the conditions and starvation and everything else, he wasn't able to properly learn. So he wrote the Makor Baruch. He wanted to prove to his father that he could learn Torah. So while he was a businessman, he wrote the Torah Tamima. The Torah Tamima, by the way, is an amazing work. He quotes pretty much every Gemara, right? The Gemara, the Tosefta, the Midrashim, right? That are on a particular verse, a particular pasuk, and then he gives a commentary on it. So if you ever want to look up an amazing Dvar Torah, an amazing thought for going somewhere for Shabbos, just a random thought, Torah Tamima is the way to go. Because it's not just saying, well, we have a question, what does Rashi say? It's, you know, the Gemara says, but the Medrash says, and the Torah Tamima says. You can't go wrong with that. So listen to this, okay? Ki ata tavo. So he quotes the Gemara. Ulalan tiv ki ata tavi amar av yochana amar lo yoshel yoshua ataus kenim shabador amar lo agash baruch hu tol makel. Just what we said. Right? This is a Gemara in Sanhedrin and Davchet. Okay? One verse, you'll go with the Jewish people, listen to the Sanhedrin, rule by consensus. One verse, you're going to have to bring them in, no matter what they say. You're the leader, there can only be one. Listen what the Torah Tamima says. Amazing. Halashon tavo et ha'am, mashma ata ve'am, ata ke'echad mehem. You as one of them. Masha'inkin halashon tavi, more she'ata tiyeh ha'mevi otam, v'haynu she'tiyeh lehem roshu manhig. And that's all he says. Atatavi, you have to be one of the people. Atatavo, you have to lead them. You have to be a leader. And then he doesn't answer the question. Like, does it make sense? The Torah Tamima never does that. He obviously understands the question, then he answers it. So he comments and doesn't answer the question. So looking at this Torah Tamima, you're trying to figure out what is he talking about. So here's what I think. I don't think that it's either or. I think it has to be both. There are times that you have to lead. You have to lead by example. You have to go out on a limb. You have to know that someone has to jump forward. But there are times where if you're out on a limb and nobody's following you, you completely miss the boat. Sometimes leadership is by consensus. It's by committee, you know? I don't know, right? That's a great example. There are a lot of things that happen here. I don't want to make a decision on my own. I know I could make the decision. I know if I really insisted on it, you know, whatever. But who wants to run yeshiva like that? Who wants to have an organization like that? You want people to feel heard. You want people to be a part of it. Never mind that Hashem has blessed us to have such brilliant rabbis here. Why on earth wouldn't you want to hear what everybody thinks? So, you have some amazing discussions. And if you put so many minds together, the result is going to be so much better than you could ever reach on your own. But sometimes you can't rule by committee. Sometimes you have to make a decision. I want you to know of all the things that were challenging to me in the army and that looking back were the greatest benefit to the army, it was the ability to make decisions. And by the way, it doesn't have to be in combat. I remember times in Milu when we had to, you know, run a maneuver. And there's a whole gdud, there's a whole battalion, and you're in charge of getting 250 guys to get to the firing ranges, get their training done, do the muscle lay prat, maneuvers that are... And if you don't do the maneuvers and they don't get everything done, then when you're out in the field on your reserve duty, somebody rusty forgets what he's supposed to do and gets killed. The logistics of the food and everything... And all the time, all these different questions come up. You don't have time to have a discussion about these things. You don't have time to have a committee. You don't even have time to think about them. You have a moment and you have to make a decision. And sometimes you'll make the wrong decision. There are only decisions. And if you don't make decisions, you'll never get anything done. And if you do make decisions, you'll make mistakes. But you'll also make right decisions. Sometimes it's got to be by consensus, and sometimes you got to lead. And the wisdom is to know the difference. That is what Moshe is telling Yeshua. Sometimes it's Zachariah. Let me tell you the end of the story of Latrun. It's funny to me because I was curious about this and I eventually started to look it up and I got a shock. Because that motif, which gave birth to the idea... By the way, just so you understand, that idea was not born in Latrun. Right? Modern day warriors thought that it was born in Latrun. That idea was actually born in Sefer Yoshua. Because in Sefer Yoshua, Hashem clearly tells Yoshua, you will lead them in. And in the second battle in Eretz Yisrael, does anybody know what the second battle is in the book of Yoshua? Anybody? Battle of?
Ai.
Victory or not?
Loss.
Right? And everybody says, right, the Jewish people, they go in, they head from east to west, they get to a place called Gilgal, they go to Mount Gerizim and Har Eval, then they head south, they go to Yericho. It's a big victory, the walls come tumbling down, and they're feeling pretty good about themselves. So they head towards Ai. That's the next big city. And in Ai, if you look at the verses, Yeshua doesn't send out the whole army. Why do we need 600,000 men for a little pitzkal Ai? We'll just send a few hundred people. And they get schmeist. 36 are killed or taken prisoner. And whether that's literal or allegorical is a story for another time. Why does that happen? So the psukim talk about how there was a guy in Achan and he stole. But the Sifra says something quite different. Sifra says, Yoshua sends the men out. And Hashem says to Yoshua, I told you that you have to lead. By the way, you know where else this happens? What famous story in the Navi ends up as a mess because a king is not fighting with his men, he's back in Jerusalem in the palace. Anybody know what story? David and Bathsheba. If you look carefully at the story of Bathsheba, right, the men of Israel are fighting the Plishtim. Right? He sends Uriah Hitti off to the front lines where he gets killed. And that's Bathsheba's husband, etc. Where is David HaMelech? Why is David not out in the battle? So the Medrash says the reason that the whole debacle of Bathsheba happens is because he's back in Jerusalem when they're out in the field. A leader has no business sitting in an armchair when his men are going to battle. You know where you see the antithesis of this? Moshe Rabbeinu. Jewish people fight Amalek. Yoshua is down in the valley. So Moshe Rabbeinu goes up on the mountain. Remember this? Every time Moshe lifts his hands, they're victorious. And every time he drops his hands, they can't. So Aaron and Hur come and support his hands. And what does Moshe do? He sits on a rock. That's what it says. Vayeshev al Aven, he sits on a rock. So the commentators notice that he sits on a rock. Why is he sitting on a rock? Sit on a pillow. You're Moshe Rabbeinu. Because if the Jewish people are suffering in battle, I shouldn't be sitting in a pillow. Because leadership doesn't happen from behind. If I'm not with the people, then I'm not of the people. But you can be of the people, you still have to lead the people. That is a very delicate balance. I remember when you become an officer in the Israeli army, it's not like in America or in England. Right? In America or England, like, you know, you're sir, yes sir, no sir, yes sir, thank you sir. Right? It's all salutes and whatever. Not in the Israeli army. In the Israeli army, you have distance, which comes from the word distance, which means that when you're in basic training, you don't call him by his name, you call him Amfaket. I have a vivid memory of the first time we went into Lebanon. We were in the army all of 2.5 months. And they took us for a week into Lebanon to do some pretty serious stuff. And our commander was a sergeant, right? We're sitting in a safari truck, and we're about to cross into Lebanon. And our commander sits us down, the Tzevet, the six guys, our sergeant, and he says, okay, from now on, I'm not sergeant, and I'm not Mefaked, I'm just Eli. And we were like in shock, because your commander is not sir in battle. Anachnu boto, we eat from the same pot of soup. And my men never called me sir. They called me Bini. That's how it works. And that creates a challenge, because on the one hand, you're above them, you're their commander, and on the one hand, you're one of them. How do you navigate that? How do you make sure that they know you're their commander, and yet they call you by your name and you live with them and you're in the same tank? That balance is the challenge that Moshe presents to Yeshua in this week's parsha. And that balance is something that accompanies you in life. You know? You become, I don't know, president of the Hillel University. You're a leader. You're not one of the guys anymore. But you are one of the guys. So how do you find that balance? When you're a parent. You know, I've seen people who there's this thing now where kids call their parents by their names. Have you seen this? I don't call her mom, I call her Mary, right? Georgette, right? Your mom is not your friend. She's your mom. Now, I'm very close with my kids, Baruch Hashem, I think, at least I was at the beginning of the week. But I'm not their buddy.
I'm their dad. And that navigation is a critical piece of navigation. On the other hand, as I'm sure Yair will tell you, I am not the overwhelming authority at which my children tremble. We can go out and we can hang out and we can be out. But there's still a line. And that line is one of the valuable lines of life. And of course, the ultimate line, that ultimate double entendre, that ultimate dichotomy, is our relationship with Hashem. On the one end, we say, Baruch Atah. We talk to God in the second person. We want a personal, I, thou, Buberian relationship with Hashem. But what do we do when we say the word Atah? Baruch Atah, what do? We bow down. Because while we want to be close to Hashem, we know Hashem loves us. It's not me and God hanging out on the street corner with a guitar. I have to be in awe of Hashem. And that imminence, right? That closeness coupled with that transcendence, that beyond, is the synergy that is the essence of Judaism. So that's a little food for thought. That is what Moshe tries to pass on to Yeshua. And Hashem should bless us all. We're entering Rosh Hashanah. We should be able to find that imminence, that close relationship with Hashem, and maintain that transcendence, and have that in our year as we go into Rosh Hashanah.